85. I'm speaking plainly with Bill Hay coming up in 30 minutes on Talk Radio WBOB.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director and Physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. I'm sure that this may have happened to you in the past. You're cruising down a road in your car when all of a sudden the motor sputters and then acts erratic and then stops, maybe giving you the ability to just get to the side of the road. You ran out of gas. Gas is the fuel that your car uses to power everything, from moving the car to recharging the battery. So what is the fuel we use? That's just part of the subject we're going to address on today's Hey Doc Show. So we're going to start at the beginning.
Every living creature requires energy to survive. From the smallest single-celled organism, like the amoeba, remember, the amoeba from high school biology, to plant and finally to animals.
We need fuel to run. We're made up of cells. Skin has cells, organs like the liver, kidney, and the pancreas. They all have cells, and our brains have cells. These cells store energy in the form of a compound called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP for short. Without ATP, the cells eventually die, and the cells need glucose, which is just a simple sugar, in order to create ATP. Now, glucose is classified as a simple sugar with a pretty simple molecular formula, C6H12O6. Now, I don't want to bog you down with formulas, but this simply means there are 6 carbon atoms, 12 hydrogen atoms, and 6 oxygen atoms in the compound. Now, again, this still may seem confusing, but by itself, it may seem complicated. But remember, water is simply H2O. That's 2 hydrogen atoms and a single oxygen atom. So glucose can be thought of as a compound that contains 6 carbon atoms and 6 water molecules.
Now, in nature, carbon can only connect to 4 other atoms. So there are a limited number of configurations that a string of carbon atoms can take while attaching to each other. For example, they could be in a string of 6 carbon atoms or 5 with 1 carbon coming off of any of the other 3 carbon atoms, etc.
Once you break down the water into compounds such as 2 hydrogen atoms and 1 oxygen atom, or 1 hydrogen atom and a compound made up of 1 hydrogen atom and a single oxygen atom, you can combine this with any of the strings of carbon to make different sugar compounds. Now, this glucose circulates in the blood of animals as blood sugar. It's made during the plant process of photosynthesis from water and carbon dioxide using energy from sunlight. And glucose is stored as starch in plants and as glycogen in animals. When you take in carbohydrates in any form, they are eventually broken down in the cells to other compounds, but mostly glucose. Remember when we mentioned photosynthesis as a way plants create glucose? Well, they create it, as we said, from carbon dioxide and water. In the body, the cells break down the glucose eventually into carbon dioxide and water, along with one other essential product, energy.
So in the body, some glucose is utilized as an energy source by brain cells. Some glucose is used by intestinal cells and red blood cells, while the rest reaches the liver, fat tissue, and muscle cells, where it is absorbed and stored as glycogen under the influence of insulin. Now, liver cells' glycogen can be converted to glucose and returned to the blood when insulin is low or absent.
In fat cells, glucose is used to power reactions that synthesize some fat types, and they may have other purposes. Glycogen, therefore, is the body's glucose energy storage mechanism because it is much more space efficient and simply less reactive than glucose itself. Now, there's a great mechanism in the body for controlling the amount of glucose in the blood and in the tissues, and it revolves around insulin, but we'll get to that later. If there's too much glucose in the blood, this impedes blood flow. If the blood doesn't flow well, then there's a decrease in the flow of oxygen to the cells that need oxygen. This could lead to cell death. And in diabetes, this tends to occur, and it is possibly the reason for eventual blindness and kidney failure in some diabetics. So blood glucose levels have to be maintained at an ideal level. Too much in the blood, and blood flow is impeded. Not enough in the cells, and the cells don't get the energy source that they need.
The body needs to self-adjust. One of the ways is through a hormone called insulin that is produced in your pancreas. Actually, it is produced only in certain cells in your pancreas called beta cells. These cells are stimulated during the process of eating and sometimes even before eating, such as when you smell food, that stimulates the beta cells to start producing insulin even before the food hits the stomach.
So the insulin molecules start arriving at the target organs even before you swallow the food. They go to muscle cells, for example, telling the cells to start absorbing glucose. Soon the blood sugar drops, which signals a decrease in insulin production and less glucose is absorbed. Thus, there's normally what we'll call an equilibrium that's reached. But there's also a fail-safe hormone called glucagon, which protects the body from getting too low a blood sugar level. Glucagon stimulates the cells to break down the glycogen. Remember, that's the storage form of glucose, and it releases glucose into the bloodstream. So the mere smell or sight of food can stimulate the production of insulin by the pancreas. The sweeter the body presumes it's going to consume, the more insulin is produced. Not only that, what you ate in the previous meal actually can help influence how much insulin is produced. The more you ate previously, the more insulin is produced.
Now, this production of insulin is not continuous. In fact, the pancreas produces insulin in spurts, about every 10 to 20 minutes, until the blood glucose returns to normal levels.
So we've mentioned only the pancreas as being the producer of insulin, but in fact, the brain also produces insulin, and insulin in the brain is thought to enhance learning and memory. Now, we've all probably during our lives been in stressful situations. This can also affect blood glucose levels. There's a hormone which you may be familiar with. We've talked about it, and it's sometimes called the fight or flight hormone. Its real name is noradrenaline, but it's also known as norepinephrine. Again, the fight or flight hormone. With stress, this hormone production is increased, and one of its effects on the body is to inhibit insulin production. Why does the body do this? Well, to be frank, the body does this to increase the sugar that's stored in muscle cells in order to avoid the danger or imminent danger that the body senses with the stress. In that way, your body has ample energy to escape danger. So not only do sweet foods increase your body's production of insulin, but stress does it as well.
There are two types of diabetes, type 1 and type 2.
In my personal opinion, I consider them two separate diseases. First, type 1 is caused by a lack of insulin production by the pancreas, and type 2 diabetes is caused by cell receptors that do not respond to the effects of produced insulin. In other words, the cells are resistant to the effects of insulin.
Both type 1 and type 2 cause increased blood glucose levels. Most people with diabetes suffer from type 2. In fact, only 10% of all those with diabetes have type 1.
The main cause of type 1 diabetes is that the type 1 diabetic simply has an immune system that destroys its own insulin-producing cells. And this leads to little or even no insulin production. Now, there are multiple results of this. First of all, type 1 diabetics cannot store food as fat, and they burn any existing fat. Thus, type 1 diabetics are often thin. But let's take a look at the type 2 diabetic. The cause of this is often that the body has too high levels of insulin production for too long a period of time.
So, in the type 2 diabetics, the more carbohydrates that are consumed, the more insulin the pancreas produces. Eventually, the constant insulin production wears down the cell's insulin receptors, and they no longer respond to the insulin. So what happens then? The pancreas must produce even more insulin, and the vicious cycle continues. Eventually, The pancreatic cells break down and can no longer produce sufficient insulin to fill the cell's receptors.
So what happens in the brain of a diabetic as all this is going on? As insulin resistance develops, over time, the brain cell's ability to absorb sugar decreases, and brain function decreases as well. This leads to increased cognitive impairment. You've probably heard that term before. Did you know that diabetics are twice as likely as non-diabetics to develop Alzheimer's disease? But we didn't come here to talk about diabetes. Instead, our real topic of the day is weight management. It's important to remember what we just said about the relationship of insulin and food. The more carbohydrates you eat, the more your body needs to produce insulin, and eventually you develop insulin resistance.
When you eat a meal, insulin binds to the insulin receptors in the brain, muscles, and liver cells. This promotes these cells to absorb glucose and store it as glycogen. But there is a limit to how much glycogen these cells can absorb. At some point, they are saturated with glycogen, and then the fat cells absorb the glucose by converting it into fat.
But it goes even further. As more insulin binds to the insulin receptors of the fat cells, and they take this fatty acid into bloodstream, they then turn them into fat droplets. And remember, high insulin levels prevent your body from using the fats, and you are now unable to burn off this excess fat. But then your body's not able to break down the glycogen to be used for energy. Instead, your body makes you crave more carbohydrates in order to get the needed energy. Again, a vicious cycle. Now you eat more, and more insulin is produced, and more fat is put on.
So let's reverse this process. Since we want to produce less insulin, we need to decrease the intake of glucose. The cells are not getting the energy they need from the food. Then it starts using the fat cells.
I can't really stress how important this is to understand if you really want to get to your ideal weight. And because it's so important, we're going to take one final example to explain it. Let's say that you're passing a bakery with a nice glass window.
Apple peaches, pumpkin pie.
You look inside and there's some delicious apple pie, just like the song says. So one day, you decide to lose weight, so you go on a low-carb diet.
You saw the pie, maybe even smelled it, as the scent wafted out of the bakery door. As soon as you did, your pancreas began producing insulin. So you go inside, buy the slice of pie and begin enjoying it. As you do, your blood glucose levels rise and the beta cells are stimulated to produce even more insulin.
All the insulin in storage gets released and it brings down your blood sugar. Since you've been on that low-carb diet, your pancreas has not been producing as much insulin as before. There might not be enough insulin to cover all the carbs in that pie. So your body stimulates the beta cells in the pancreas, and they produce and release insulin, in pulses this time, every 10 to 20 minutes. That is, until the blood glucose levels come back to normal. Now your body anticipates your next carb increase, maybe another piece of cake or a spaghetti dinner with lots of pasta sauce. So the beta cells produce extra insulin as the body prepares for the next glucose-laden meal.
That next cookie or cake may only contain 30 calories each, but if they have a high sugar content, then they will cause the insulin levels to rise excessively. This causes your body to store the extra energy as fat. And that is because insulin is not only in control of glucose levels, but fat storage as well.
So one theory is that to lose weight, you need to regulate insulin production in the body.
It's time for our mid-show break. So Carmen and I will be back in just a moment.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Now that we've talked about the why of a good diet, let's talk about the how.
Well, let's talk about the SAD foods and obesity. Well, in this case, SAD, S-A-D, stands for Standard American Diet.
Fried chicken is a staple of the SAD, and we all understand that it is a high-calorie food with a lot of fat content. But it may not be these fats, but rather the increase in insulin it causes, just like the apple pie.
Fried chicken is often breaded, which increases the carbohydrates. You may have mashed potatoes with it, with gravy, which is often sweetened with corn syrup, as an added sugar. Coleslaw seems innocuous, but often also contains sugar. And then you might top that off with a biscuit, which will have a high glycemic index. So in a nutshell, insulin regulates how the body uses and stores glucose and fat. Insulin helps control blood glucose levels by signaling the liver, the muscles, and fat cells to take in glucose from the blood, whereby the cells can use the glucose energy. However, if the body has sufficient energy, insulin signals the liver to take up glucose, and this time store it as glycogen. And it can store huge amounts, about 5% of its mass, as glycogen, which I think ends up being somewhere around 3 ounces of fat. Most cells do require insulin to store glucose, but not all. The brain does not depend on insulin for glucose storage.
In the absence of insulin, most cells in the body become unable to take up glucose and begin a switch to using alternative fuels, like fatty acids for energy. Nerve cells, however, require a constant supply of glucose, which in the short term is provided from glycogen reserves.
When insulin levels in the blood fall, glycogen synthesis in the liver diminishes, and enzymes that are responsible for breakdown of glycogen become active. Glycogen breakdown is stimulated not only by the insulin absence, but by the presence of glucagon, which is secreted when blood glucose levels fall below the normal range. Now, 10,000 years ago, our ancestors consumed about 20 teaspoons of sugar a year. A single 20-ounce soda or even sports drink contains about 17 teaspoons of sugar per drink. Today, the average American consumes not 20 teaspoons a year, but around 160 pounds of sugar per year. So just forget about our 10,000-year-old ancestors. Just 200 years ago, in the early 1800s, the average intake of sugar was only about 4 to 6 pounds per person per year. I'm sure that a lot of you who wish to lose weight have opted to go with low-fat items. The problem here is that often these low-fat items, in order to sell, must contain sugar in order to taste good. This, of course, does include those low-fat salad dressings.
The diet plan that we are talking about does restrict carbohydrates, but not all, since some carbohydrates do spike insulin levels while others do not. We need to concentrate on some foods that, along with decreasing the calories, do not increase insulin production. The goal here is to increase the proteins and fiber in the diet.
All carbohydrates can be classified as monosaccharides, disaccharides, or polysaccharides, with the monosaccharide being any sugar that cannot be broken down into a simple sugar. So it's the simplest sugar. That's, again, the monosaccharides. Have you heard of starch? We talked about it just a couple of minutes ago. Not the type that people, of course, use to put in collars to stiffen them, but the ingestible version. Well, starch is a complex carbohydrate, and it's usually found in fruits, grains, and that includes potatoes, while glycogen is the animal form of glucose storage.
Starchy foods are broken down into glucose in the human body, but enzymes that work on something called alpha bonds. Also, heat breaks down alpha bonds, and it is the reason that cooked foods cause a rise in insulin levels faster than uncooked foods. So, the quick rise in glucose levels stimulates the pancreatic beta cells to produce more insulin.
Refined sugars are usually already cooked and ground, which also breaks those alpha bonds. As we said, starches need to be broken down to be able to be used in the body. And there are three groups of starches: readily available, slowly available, and resistant starch. So we get to something called the glycemic index. I just briefly mentioned it somewhere in the talk just a couple of moments ago. This measures how carbohydrates react in your blood. It's a simple index going from 0 to 100, and it's based on how quickly they raise the blood sugar level. Pure sugar has a glycemic index of around 100. This causes a really quick rise in insulin levels.
A food with a very low glycemic index is almonds, with a GI of 0. Now, you heard right, 0.
Foods with a low glycemic index also make you feel fuller and give you more energy. So to cut to the chase, look for foods with GI of less than 55. And really try to steer away from those with a glycemic index of more than 69.
Also remember that foods have different quantities of carbohydrates. So the GI is not the only thing that you need, since GI is really calculated on a per carbohydrate basis. What you really might need to look for is a per serving, and that is the glycemic load. Oh no, not another crazy term to memorize. Nope, this one's easy. Glycemic load is the food's glycemic index simply multiplied by the amount of carbohydrates, and it's measured in grams, and then divided by 100.
What you are looking for are foods with a glycemic load of 10 or less. Watch out for those foods with a glycemic load of 20 or more.
Before we end today's show, let's talk about fiber. Remember the monosaccharides like glucose? Well, cellulose is a polysaccharide, and that literally contains thousands of glucose molecules that are linked together. But here's the difference. It's the type of bond that keeps them together. These are not alpha bonds that we've talked about again just a couple of minutes ago. These are now called beta bonds. Because we as humans lack the enzyme to break these beta bonds, when we eat cellulose, which is a fiber that's seen in green leafy vegetables, we simply cannot digest them. On the other hand, cows do have the enzymes, so they can get the energy out of grass and even wood. Tastes delicious. There are two types of fibers, those that dissolve in water and those that do not. This is simple. Soluble fibers, those are included that are found in flaxseed, fruits, and vegetables. And they help hydrate the intestinal contents, and they move contents down the intestines. Just adding soluble fiber to the diet can reduce intake by 11%.
And finally, at least for today's discussion, there are insoluble fiber that helps produce bulk and mass to the stool, which are these: whale kale, spinach, nuts, seeds, bran, quinoa, and whole grain foods.
To really explain diet and healthy eating, Carmen and I will need a whole lot more than just one 30-minute show. If you'd like to learn more, we invite you to send us an email asking us to do more shows on diet and good food. And if we get enough response, well, we'll record a special show for all of you who request it. Our email is livelonger@gmail.com. Again, livelonger@gmail.com.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.